Hi, this is John Delancey, and you are listening to the GeekCast Radio Network.
Did you miss me, Celestia?
I miss you.
It's quite lonely being encased in stone, but you wouldn't know that, would you? Because I don't turn ponies into stone.
The Continuum didn't think you had it in you, Jean-Luc. But I knew you did. I was the one that got you into it. A directive from the Continuum. The part about the helping hand, though, was my idea. The trial never ends. We wanted to see if you had the ability to expand your mind and your horizons. And for one brief moment, you did.
When I realized the paradox.
Exactly. For that one fraction of a second, you were open to options you had never considered. That is the exploration that awaits you.
Hello, and welcome to this special GeekCast Radio interview. I'm your host, Steve Megatron Phillips, and joining me in this awesome interview is...
Kevin Optimus Solo Thompson. Hello, Steve.
Hello. And we are interviewing today John Delancey. Hello, John.
Hello. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Well, you know what? It explains this UK thing explains why what I was concerned about in terms of being a lot of jet lag talking to a bunch of guys who were, you know, like 5 o'clock in the morning. So okay, we're on.
We're much better.
Yeah, we're much better.
Awesome. We're going to start out with a couple of just general background questions and starting those out. Where did you grow up at?
I grew up in Philadelphia. I grew up in Philadelphia, Center City, for the first, 7 or 8 years. And then, my folks moved out to the suburbs, and then I left Philadelphia when I was about 18.
Nice. How did growing up with dyslexia affect your life, and do you have any advice for the many other people out there facing the same types of challenges you've faced?
Well, it was difficult. I mean, it was really difficult, because when I went to school, people didn't know about anything about dyslexia. So they just figured that I was a little slow, and I flunked out of, at least two places, until I got to a school in the sixth grade, which was pretty much for kind of wayward kids, probably a lot of whom had dyslexia. And the headmistress of the school said, well, I think that he has dyslexia. Now, that was okay with me, because it was better to find out I had dyslexia than to just be told I was stupid again. But it isn't as if anybody did anything about it. There wasn't anything to do. It was a name, and it gave some sort of credence to why it was that I could be, you know, fairly clever on certain things and really behind the eight ball in others.
What was it that finally kind of let you get over the hump there, especially going on into a field that, you know, with lines and, you know, acting in general, that would be so much, there'd be so much focus on, you know, the reading and everything else?
Well, I think that, like a lot of people, you tend to gravitate towards the things sometimes that you don't do that well, and you overcompensate. I was in class in sixth grade, probably hacking around in the back, and my teacher came in, and the next thing I knew, I had a book bounce off my chest. He threw a book across the room, and it bounced off my chest and fell onto my desk. And he said, probably along with be quiet and a fair amount of other expletives, he said, 2 months from now, we're going to do Henry V. This was during the spring. 2 months from now, we're going to do Henry V, and Delancey, you're going to play Hal. And he went around the room and assigned part. Now, I then had to go and read the play, which was excruciating. And, well, actually, I had to read the play, which was difficult, but then I had to memorize, and that was excruciating. I just didn't know how to memorize. And to this day, I am not really very good at it, and it gives me a lot of anxiety. I don't know why. My wife, who is not dyslexic, can learn very complicated stuff in a very, very short time while I am still struggling. The only difference is that once I've got it, I seem to know kind of what to do with it, you know, maybe certainly as well, if not in certain instances better than others. But it's always been a struggle, and it will always remain a struggle.
So what was it exactly that that made you decide to get into the acting business? And if you could tell us about landing your first official role as an actor.
Well, after all of this discussion about struggle and what have you, and flunking, and having to learn this stuff and perform it, I went ahead and did that. And at the end of that performance outside on that day in May, everybody crowded around me and said, "Wow, you're really good at this." And there was a guy there who had come to see his granddaughter, who went up to my father and said, "You know, if your son wants to do this, he should. You should encourage him because he's actually really good at this." Now, this guy happened to be the editor of the Pelican Shakespeares for, you know, well, those Shakespeare books that every school kid used to have. And so that was the first time in my life that I had ever had any positive feedback in school. And so I just glommed on to that. I mean, that was like, oh, my God, this is fantastic. You know, little did I know that each and every time that the learning of my lines was not going to really become that much easier as time went on, because it took me a very, very long time to even understand how to learn lines. But that was something. So now we jump forward. I ended up going to Juilliard. I was very fortunate in being able to go there. And I had had a bunch of other jobs in between that, but probably the first really official job was being in the American Shakespeare Company up in Stratford, Connecticut. Then I came back into New York, and I auditioned for a bunch of stuff, and I got an opportunity to be in a movie, and I went out to Los Angeles, and then I worked at Universal for 2 years, where I did many, many, many shows, and then I got tired of that, and I went up to Seattle, back into the theater, and then, you know, so I was, you know, up and running. I mean, I think that I was, for the most part, pretty naive and rather immature. One thing that was helpful is that in my younger days, I sort of looked like an actor. You know, I was good enough looking that was helpful, where sometimes my acting was probably not quite as good as it should have been.
Was there a certain, last question on this topic, but was there a certain point where you, did you know right from the beginning that this is what you wanted to do long term, or was there a certain point where it clicked and you said, you know, you figured out that this is definitely what you want to stick with?
Well, I really hadn't thought about it. And when you figure, I started acting when I was 14. By the time I was 28, I now was actually making my living at it. But I was making my living at it in such a way that, you know, it was a struggle, not as much as a lot of people had. I've been very fortunate, but it was enough of a struggle for me to go, God, is this something I really want to do? It was at that time that I sort of sat myself down and realized I'm full into this now. I have no other profession. I mean, there isn't anything else I'm good at. It isn't like I'm going to go back and get my PhD, you know. I mean, for better or for worse, I was stuck. And so it was at that point that I thought, you know, I really need to start thinking about this in a way that will make me successful and not just a feather for every wind.
Right.
Jumping gears a little bit more into something a little bit more specific, do you have a favorite show that you've had the pleasure of working on?
Well, Breaking Bad is an awfully good show. You know, I think it's Vince, the creator of that, is just about the best. I mean, oh my gosh. He's just amazing. And so I enjoyed that. I enjoyed the last show I was in, which I don't think is going to go anywhere, but it was Torchwood, I thought, did a pretty good job. Those are some of the shows that you would have seen of late.
Gotcha. What about specifically looking at all of the different Star Trek-related projects that you've been involved with? Is it possible for you to pick a favorite out of all of them?
Well, Star Trek clearly is a defining show for me, to the extent that, you know, my grave will say best known as. I went, by the way, I was doing a play not too long ago, a couple months or so ago, sometimes on the Saturdays or Sundays in between shows, we would go and have lunch in the cemetery. It's the celebrity cemetery in Westwood. And Marilyn Monroe is there, and, you know, and Merv Griffin and what have you. And some of the grave markers are fantastic. Merv Griffin's is, I will not be back. After a brief commercial.
Nice.
And then there was some actor, and I wish I could remember his name, but it's so kind of, he goes, yeah, I'm going to come up with a name, you know, Bob Gray, a fine actor, weather permitting.
Oh, geez.
So there were lots of, so in any case, oh God, now I forgot your question.
It was just out of all the different Star Trek projects, if you had a particular favorite.
Oh, well, sure. I think for me the Next Gen was the more, you know, substantive show. The last episode, All Good Things, was a place where I could sort of do. I didn't have a great deal to do, but each scene sort of was pivotal, or at least character-wise, it was pivotal,
right.
And that I could present a new facet. You know, each one had a little different facet of this character called Q.
Is it true that when they were going to make that last episode of the Next Generation, I read somewhere that you had approached Rick Berman and asked if you could be in that final episode? Is that a factual thing?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
No. I mean, I'm delighted. I'm delighted on being in it, but it's very awkward in asking producers for work. It places them in an awkward position if that's not really what they want to do, and it places you in a position where, you know, you're being told essentially. I always think of it as like asking somebody, am I going to be invited to your dinner party?
Right.
You know, it's like, no. Oh, my God. So I never ask.
Makes sense.
Yeah, that was kind of a nice bookend, though, having Q in the first episode and the final episode of TNG.
Yeah, I think so, too. And, I mean, you know, for most people, most people think that I was a series regular on the show. Right. I mean, most people think when I say to them, well, how many episodes do you think I was in on all three shows? All, you know, Deep Space and
Voyager.
Oh, they go, oh, my God, I don't know, 20, 30? I said, well, try nine. Nine. There would be shows in which people would say, no, you were in that. And I go, actually, I wasn't. He goes, well, you know, really? Well, you should have been in it, you know?
Well, I think it's just a testament to how much of an impact that character had.
Well, there's no question. The character had an impact which was disproportionate to the amount of times he traipsed around on set.
Right.
Yeah.
So what project has posed the biggest challenge that you've had? That you've been a part of?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, you know, since we talked about line learning, Man and Superman with the Don Juan section represented about 3 hours and 50 minutes of me talking at high speed on stage, that was terrifying. And also, because I did it, it was exhilarating. I've written a fair amount of shows for symphony orchestras, and they are fraught with all sorts of production issues that don't usually exist in the theater. But you know, the symphony orchestras are not producing instruments, and so trying to get a sort of theatrical production up in a symphony environment has been super challenging. I don't know. I mean, one of the things, and I'm changing the subject a little bit, is that some actors just like to act. They just enjoy that, and regardless of, almost regardless of what the material is, that state that you get in is something that is for them is everything. I'm not somebody like that. I really need to think the material is good and really somehow have a feel for the material above and beyond just wanting to have the job. And so I tend to work less and less because I don't really want to sit around the set. I have other things that I do that also take up time, and time is becoming more and more precious. So I'm doing a little tiny, I don't know what it's going to be, 12-minute little short for a guy next week. And I'm doing it only because the material, I go, oh, this is very interesting. It's a story of a psychologist who is counseling a woman who cannot accept the fact that her husband is gone and is not coming back. And she has turned it into that he actually has run off with another woman. And what we realize in this very short is that her husband died in 9/11. And what we also discover is that my wife died in 9/11. So we are two people in real pain trying to deal with this issue, and we are hooked together. There's a symbiotic relationship that we have, and just as a little, it's a little tiny project, and I just thought, oh, well, that sounds really interesting. Let's see where that goes. So that's the type of stuff. I mean, along with, I just finished doing in Philadelphia, L'Histoire de Soldat, which is a Stravinsky piece. I was in Rochester about a month ago now, doing a new piece for a symphony orchestra, which is a very exciting piece. It's a Dr. Seuss piece about the Sneetches. I didn't know this. And the Sneetches was used in Bosnia by the NATO commander at the time to try. He ordered, something like a half a million books printed up of the Sneetches in Croatian, to distribute to the people there to try to get them to stop killing each other. A wonderful man by the name of Dr. Sidney Sobel, a doctor in the way in which the arts has always been. He's a patron of the arts. He has commissioned. He went and got the rights from the Seuss estate because he feels very strongly about this piece. And then he went and got commissioned a Spanish composer by the name of Lorenzo Palomo, Palomo, and me as the narrator. And we're doing a two piano version of it in Rochester, as I said, about 3 weeks ago. And then it's going to premiere at Oberland, and then it's going to start making its rounds to symphony orchestras around the world.
Cool.
The point is that whatever is interesting.
Right.
Oh, yeah. I can definitely understand that. Out of the several animated shows you've been a part of, what has been one of your favorites to have worked on?
I don't really... Now, the experience is really sort of, it's a difficult, you don't get too connected with it. You know, if I only come in, you know, once or whatever. I mean, the one that's going on right now is My Little Pony, which I thought was a kid's show. little did I know that there's such a world as bronies, and, you know, my understanding of all that. I actually asked somebody, is this coded? Is this a coded show that really means something else? And they said, no, it isn't. So there's that. I just finished doing a game, sort of a fun game. I cannot remember the name of it, though. I don't know. You have to help me with the...
Is it Assassin's Creed? Or?
Oh, I did Assassin's Creed. That was very interesting. I really had a sense that I was working with people who really, you know, obviously they know their business very well, and it was fun. That was nice. That was nice, yeah.
Kind of going, you mentioned a couple of different things here, working with the symphonies and the orchestras. You've obviously done theater work, you've done film work, television work, video games, cartoons. Do you have a favorite medium within that whole... You know, that within the whole acting genre, is there one that you prefer, or one that just kind of is a personal favorite out of yours?
No, I don't. I tend to, if I'm doing a play, which I just finished doing, you know, after 3 months, 4 months, I'm really ready to get out of that.
Mm-hmm.
I just like the variety of stuff. I like that. In a way, though, I mean, just from a technical point of view, sometimes you don't get, you know, you become a jack of all trades sort of person. But I mostly enjoy just being able to go from one different project to the next. The notion of doing a play for 2-3 years is really abhorrent to me. I just can't imagine. And I know that there are a lot of actors who think that that's absolutely fantastic, but I just would hate it. I absolutely would hate it.
Yeah.
In the same way that doing a television series. I mean, I did 2 or 3 television series, and you know, and they would last a long time, and it's a real grind, and it's I sort of go dead upstairs after a while.
Makes sense. Was there ever, if you can remember, was there ever a project that you were involved with, whether it, you know, be most likely a TV show or something like that, that you're really excited and thought would go places or do great that never really materialized? Or was there something that you thought was completely hopeless that you were, once it got involved, but it really took off and was successful and you didn't expect it?
Well, Legend... the television show Legend was something that I thought was going to run for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
And most people who saw it just loved it. And I thought that it was a shoo-in. And we did 13 episodes, and that was it. I don't. There are a number of reasons why that was it, and I don't think it had anything to do with the show. I think it had everything to do with being on a new network, them not having the affiliates to be able to make sure the show was, you know, given its due.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it would be at 1 o'clock in the morning, or you know, 10 o'clock in the morning. You know, I mean, just ridiculous. Shows that I thought of that I didn't think were going to be successful and were. No, I have not.
And it probably kind of goes into the fact that you seem pretty careful, like you said, about the roles that you're picking, and you know, you want that kind of value to it. So it kind of makes sense that you wouldn't get involved with something if you didn't think it was going to go off, you know, take off.
Right. I mean, you know, everybody goes into a show hoping and expecting, you know, there's a sort of a suspension of of reality or disbelief or whatever you want to call it. You go in going, oh, this is great and stuff like that. And then it's only when, you know, other people get involved that you begin to say, oh, well, geez, I guess I misread that. I mean, I just came from a show tonight that my wife was doing. She'd been working on it for the last 2 months. And I would say the last 2 weeks have been a constant. She has been so down on the show that, oh my God, it's just going to be terrible. It's not going to work. It's all this effort and stuff like that. And I went to see the show this afternoon, and it was really good. And then I went back tonight. That was a sort of a dress rehearsal, and then there was the performance tonight. These are kids in the high school of the performing arts, and they're they had to write a show. They picked a show. They picked a story, really interesting story. One of the first prototypes for science fiction, a Chinese story that dates back to the 13th century.
Wow.
It's one of the first stories that is in human history that has a character come from another planet. It actually isn't another planet. It's the moon, and she comes from the moon, and she's a daughter of the moon or something like that. Oftentimes you do shows that you do say, oh my, you know, you get into it thinking it's going to be fabulous, and then you go through a period where you go, this is going to be hell. And it's just going to be terrible, and then the gods of the theater come down and smile on that night, and everything seems to work itself out.
What prompted the creation of Alien Voices?
I was doing a bunch of shows for LA Theater Works, and LA Theater Works is a producing arm of, or their shows are on NPR, and they are plays, and they're plays that are done as radio shows. And I had been with LA Theater Works for a long time, and I had done a number of their shows, and I had directed a bunch of shows. I've acted and directed a bunch of shows. They were looking for ways to be able to sort of bring in, you know, new audiences and what have you. And I had suggested to Susan that we do War of the Worlds. And, at that time, I also wanted to have a sequel to War of the Worlds. So I called Howard Koch in Woodstock, New York, and asked him if he would write a sequel to War of the Worlds. He was very old at the time. He was 90, and he really, in the end, was not up to the task. But Nat Sigaloff, a writer friend of mine, he and I did, in fact, write the sequel to it. And so I put together a science fiction cast made up of science fiction actors, the vast majority of them from Star Trek. Susan really didn't know who they were. But let me tell you, the night we opened, we had people, you know, around the block. A lot of people did not get into that opening show. And so it was very successful. The headliner of that show was Leonard Nimoy. Mm-hmm. When the show was over, I said, Leonard, did you have a good time? And he said, oh, yeah, I had a great time. And I said, well, I have an idea. So he and I talked, and I said, I'd like to bring Nat in. And you and I, and my idea is to do classic science fiction. The reason I wanted to do classic science fiction, and now I'm beginning to see that probably a lot of my life has to do with this dyslexia stuff, is that my first book that I read from cover to cover and enjoyed immensely, I was probably around 13. It was about the time that I began to be able to read, you know, at enough of a speed so that I could sort of enjoy the process. And that book was Jules Verne's Mysterious Island. And it not only was it a book that I, as I said, I really enjoyed, but it was a book that has gone on to impress me in many different ways. I just thought it was fantastic that here were a bunch of guys who had nothing. And when they fell into the sea, when the balloon finally deflates and they fall into the sea, they arrive on this island with nothing, and they created through their wits and their understanding of science and what have you. They created essentially a utopian society as best it could be done. I remember putting the book down when I was reading it, in bed. I would put the book down and just think about it, because they would go, one guy would go, I see against this hill, I see that there's a lot of iron ore. That means we will be able to create a forge, and we'll be able to make metal. I go, oh my God, how would they know that? Oh, this is fantastic. And I wanted to be somebody like that, I just thought it was just great. So I said I want to go back, and I went on to read many of the classic science fictions, the Wells, the Vernes. I read many, many of those, and I said I'd like to go back and do that. And one of the things is that I want to make sure that I do it in a way that is respectful to the book, because at the end of that summer when I read the Mysterious Island, the movie came out, and I was like, oh my God, the movie, this is fantastic. And I went to the matinee to see the movie. Well, the movie opens up with a bunch of dinosaurs on the beach, and I go, what the hell is this? There are no dinosaurs in the book. And then from the sea on a raft arrived two very blousy women. And I stood up amongst, a theater filled of kids my age. So, they're all 13. And I started screaming, this is not the story. This is not what was in the book. This was not it. And I got collared and I got thrown out. And I just thought, God damn it. God damn it. I mean, this is just not acceptable. So here it was many years later that I am, talking to Leonard Nimoy. And I'm going, Leonard, we're going to do, what do you think? And he goes, I think it's a great idea. And I said, okay, well, Nat and I will, we will read these books and we will create radio shows from these books, and from the script of these radio shows, we then can do other things. We can create television shows out of them, which is what we did for the Sci-Fi Channel, and then we had deals with other companies. So that's where all of that came from.
Yeah, I've listened to a couple of them, most notably being the First Men on the Moon.
There was Time Machine, Journey to the Center of the Earth, The Invisible Man. As a matter of fact, I've just put them on. I've just put them up where you can download them now. What is it called? AlienVoices.net. I think that's right. AlienVoices.net. If you go to Alien, actually, I can do it while we're talking. If you can go to AlienVoices.net, you can go there and you will see that they are all there to be downloaded.
Very cool. What are some future plays or projects that you'd like to add to that brand name, or some other things that you'd like to revisit?
You mean for Alien Voices?
Yes.
Well, Leonard and I are not doing Alien Voices anymore. I mean, what happened is that we had a wonderful time in the 4 years that we did it. But like all good things... it came to an end, and it came to an end in no small way, because we ended up moving from being creators to being salesmen. Mm-hmm. And we just didn't want to sell stuff. I mean,
Right. Yeah.
And then we had different ideas about how you sell it, and then handing it off to other people, and then you kind of go, well, why are they doing that? And it just became a labor of love became burdensome. And since it was never a thing that, you know, that either of us were actually making our living from, you know, so that was that. You know, we just said, look, that's sort of it.
Right.
Yeah. I floated an idea about a year ago, right at Halloween, about a year ago, which is I went into my garage and I did The Raven with the help of a friend. I did The Raven. And it's pretty good, and it's really straight right into the camera. But it's a pretty intense read. The last time I looked, it had something like 70,000 people had seen it. And my intention, I think we've got a theme here. My intention was for teachers to play this to kids who, because one of the things I didn't add to any of this is that I taught myself how to read through poetry. When I would look at a page of a book, the typeface would be always sort of floating. And I was like, whoa, and everything looked really dense. Mm-hmm. But poetry, and those poetry books, especially the whatever it's called, the treasury of poetry or something like that, they were spaced on the page kind of in a pleasing manner, you know, and they were little blurbs, you know, a half a dozen lines or maybe at the most a page, what have you. And so I use those as a way to practice. And so I have a good heartfelt feeling about poetry. So this was going to be I was going to create a whole bunch of those. And maybe I still will. I mean, I've gone up there, you know, I go up on that site every once in a while, and people are always saying, oh my God, would you do Xanadu? Or you've got to do the Rime of the Ancient Mariner. Or what about, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, so one of these days, I might do that. And the people who, the comments that are the most wonderful for me are the ones in which somebody will say, I'm a teacher of a, you know, sixth grade class, and I played this, the kids were absolutely mesmerized, and it got them to realize that, you know, just words and ideas can be really fun, those things are very gratifying.
What are some of your favorite characters out of the many you've played over the years? Like, do you have one in particular that's your favorite, or do you just whatever happens to catch your attention at the time?
It's sort of whatever catches my attention at the time. I mean, Jack in Man and Superman, Byron in Child Byron. I really grew to love Byron. I really think, you know, you research a lot when you play these characters, and I grew to really love him. I thought he was great. And Eugene in Days of Our Lives, it was a really silly, wonderful, wonderful romp. 3 years of absolute fun, great fun. Q, of course. What else? I don't know. Bartok, which was Nikola Tesla. That was wonderful. I don't know. Those are some that I can think of.
Cool. You mentioned Q. How exactly did you come up with the personality and the character of Q, and how you portrayed what was in the script for that character? Was a lot of it outlined in the script, or was a lot of that just stuff that you chose to, as far as how you envisioned the character?
Usually, especially in television, where these things are not always that sketched out, they're really waiting for somebody to come in and hand them the role on a silver platter. Mm-hmm. I happened to have been doing right then and there. I mean, I was in rehearsal for a show called Terra Nova, which was at the Taper. And I was playing the character of Amundsen. Now, that character was Amundsen, who got to the South Pole before Scott did. And he was a bigger-than-life character. So, and I myself tend to be a little, perhaps a little overly, you know, a little too big. but in any case, all of that stuff was, all of those juices were flowing, okay? Mm-hmm. And so they called me in, they asked me to do an audition, and I went in, I looked at the material, and I kind of knew, I don't know, I just... He's an arrogant son of a bitch who happens to enjoy himself. He's mad, bad, dangerous to know, which is Byron, which is what was said about Byron. He's omnipotent with clay feet. You know, he's the most powerful person in the world, in the universe, but too stupid to know it. I mean, it's whatever are the juxtapositions of those two things, you know.
Right.
And so I went in and I delivered it. Bam. And I think it was at that moment that they went, one of the things, especially in television and movies and what have you, is that you don't have a ramp-up time. You know, it isn't like, well, in 3 weeks, you'll get the character and stuff like that. What you do in the office is what you need to be able to do tomorrow morning at 6 in the morning. So if you can come in as full-blown as that, then, and obviously I nailed it. So... I nailed something that they might not have known was quite there. You know, they certainly had no sense of it having humor in it. So that was something that was not part and parcel of anything in the scripts until I brought that.
And I'm assuming that when you auditioned for that character in the beginning, am I right to say that that was a guest role that didn't necessarily have future appearances planned?
Right. That was a one shot.
Right.
That was a one shot. And Gene's, Roddenberry's original notion was that they were going to just go right into making episodes. But he lost the battle of it being an MOW, 2-hour MOW. And so... In the process of losing that battle, he had to come up with, like, well, how do I extend the story that I have? And which took him only a certain distance, so that he had to bring in kind of the B story or whatever, you know, another story. And you can see that, and I haven't watched, you know, I watched it maybe twice, the show, but... And many years ago, but you can see the seam in there. I mean, you can go, oh wow, boy, we really took a right turn there. It's really stitched together not very elegantly. Of these two stories, and there are many reasons why that became successful. Flamboyant. People love the notion of having power and having no responsibility.
Right.
Whatever I brought to it, the tweaking, whatever they brought, who knows? It's obviously, you know, all of these things are of a collaborative nature. So any actor or any writer or any director who says it's all them is wrong. It's a collaboration, and even when all is said and done, you go into the editing room and it's yet another collaboration. So
yeah, all the stars have to align.
That's right. So, and I guess the stars aligned.
After it obviously became, you know, a recurring character, and then obviously appeared in different series. Looking back, once the, you know, once the Q character had run its span, looking back at the character after the fact, did you how did you feel about the character overall? Did you, were you able to do everything with the Q character that you wanted to? Was there things that you wish you could have been able to explore with that character, or at the end did you feel like you had done everything you could do with that character?
Well, you know, the biggest problem with the character is that and I had gone through this experience actually on the soap opera. I would say, do not write me funny. My sense of the undercut, my sense of the irony and sort of that wise ass thing will give it enough of that. But do not write me funny. Because nobody is really a comedy writer, and this is not a comedy show. Let me give the wink and a nod. Sometimes that was successful, and sometimes it went over the line. The best shows were always the shows that had to do with big philosophical issues. Now, you could have a little bit of humor in there, but by and large, what's driving that show is, you know, you humans have so screwed up your own backyard. What makes you think that you have any right to come out here? Is suicide a reasonable choice to make? You have one more opportunity to get your life back. What will you do with that? You know, I mean, these type of things, you kind of go, oh, well, these are pretty big ideas. Whether Q loves Vosh, mm-hmm, is like, who cares? those were not as good, and I don't sort of remember them for that reason.
Makes sense.
Yeah,
I've noticed that you're pretty widespread in all the areas of the acting field. What has it been like working on so many iconic shows?
Well, like
Stargate, Star Trek, Breaking Bad, Torchwood.
Especially like the science fiction, especially iconic science fiction shows.
Well, I was just going to say those are genre shows. Fine. It's when you're on a major show that's doing really well, it's great fun to be on. You know, The West Wing is great fun to be on. Everything is clicking at a high level. And then there are lesser shows where you just feel it. You're cranking it out, and it's not as interesting.
What are some of your favorite film roles that you've had the pleasure of being in, or like, is there one in particular that stands out from the rest?
Well, the one in which I enjoyed the most, and it's the most bittersweet as far as I'm concerned, was my work with Peter Weir in Fearless. I had many scenes with Jeff Bridges. We were about his that had to do with everything up until getting onto the plane and all that type of stuff. And then I got a call from Weir saying, I want to tell you that we've decided to cut all the scenes up until the plane. And I went, oh my God, my God. I thought that this was going to be something that was going to be really great for my career, as well as being involved with some really wonderful people. And, I made some impression, but not nearly. I don't know. I went from like 7 or 8 scenes to one. so it was just like, whoa. Who else? I don't know. I'd have to look at my resume. No, I'll look at it here. I will bring it up.
I know you're in, Reign Over Me and Multiplicity, and you did the letter reading for Saving Private Ryan.
You're in Gamer.
They're fine. They're fine. Mm-hmm. There's nothing special.
What has it been like over the years dealing with the fan bases like you have? Like, so obviously Star Trek has insane fan base. I don't mean it in a negative way, but you know, there's so many of them out there. And your recent exposure to the My Little Pony fan base, what has it been like just interacting with such passionate fans?
Well, they are Hand That Rocks the Cradle. That was great fun. I see that. Fisher King. That was, it was wonderful working with Terry Gilliam. The Big Time is a show that you guys never saw, I'm sure, but that was really wonderful. That was a wonderful show about the move from radio to television in the late 1930s, early 1940s. And I play one of the radio act. I play the radio actor who, in fact, cannot make the transition. It was an interesting thing. I'm sorry, ask me the question again.
Sorry, it's just about dealing with the your interactions with some passionate fan bases like Star Trek, My Little Pony. Yes.
You know what? They are like, they are no different than the people who meet you at the stage door after a show. The only difference is that, you know, sometimes it's like 20 years later. They're, you know, and they're asking you questions as if you just finished the show. But the vast majority of the, you know, what would be considered the, you know, ultra fans are very sweet, very respectful, very in many cases very smart people who just happen to, you know, like that show.
Right. Have you been to any of like the different fan conventions for?
Oh yes, I've been to many of them. Yeah, and they're terrific. I mean, and they're terrific. They, you know, I mean, I consider this to be the science fiction has essentially offered the sanctuary from the other half of the population, which would want to be at you know, a NASCAR race or a sporting event. It's a little bit of a gentler crowd, and they are well read in many instances, and so, you know, it allows for a sense of science. They enjoy science, and then they enjoy fiction, and then they enjoy computers and movies and history and costumes and, you know, all that type of stuff. So it's great.
I actually had the pleasure of actually meeting you one time at a Star Trek convention back in, I think it was 94.
Yeah, I remember.
I know. Long time ago.
Yeah.
Were there any funny inside gags you had while being involved with any of these different projects?
You know, everybody asks me that, and the people who you can ask and they will actually say, oh, yes, are the ones who are usually series regulars, because there are certain days that they have, frankly, virtually nothing to do. Just nothing to do, okay? I mean, there are other days where they have a lot to do, but they're in the course of a of 50, whatever 25 episodes. There are times and weeks actually where they just don't have anything to do, so they can play little games and stuff like that. When on for Star Trek, one of the actresses actually said to me one day, she says, "You have more lines in one episode than I have in an entire year." So when I would go on, I was really jammed. And then add to that the fact that I'm saying these words for the first time, which means I've had to learn them, which now goes back to the tension and unpleasantness of having to learn lines. And there was nothing necessarily, I mean, there were days that it was fun if I didn't have a great deal to do, but it was never relaxed or fun enough for me to be screwing around at that level.
Mm. Yeah, I can kind of see that.
You know, and because understand, if I if I fiddle fart around in the morning and I have really lots of work to do in at the end of the day, the time that I will want, oh, can we do that? Can we just do that take again? Can we, you know, let me just think here, okay, that will all be gone. Right. That time will have been, that will have been eaten up. So I was always very protective about that. That doesn't mean that I wasn't part of my success there was to be, you know, silly and naughty and sort of pranksterish. But in terms of just the everyday, just the getting the work done, it was, I just didn't have time for those sort of pranks.
Who were some of your role models when you were growing up that influenced you for acting?
Well, probably people who did not help me understand what acting was like. But in any case, Basil Rathbone, Adolphe Manjou, all of these character actors that I saw, it was a very long time before I began to understand that acting naturally was part and parcel. I was all about just the choices, all these great choices, these, you know, sometimes operatic choices, and not recognizing that the style, even from when they were acting to when I was a little kid, was moving very directly towards more and more psychological. I just finished watching a film a couple of nights ago, a crazy title, 44-inch chess. You'd think it's some sort of porn thing or something, but I mean, it was a wonderful British movie, and the acting style in it is really is so current and so tremendous. But it was certainly not what Basil Rathbone and Adolphe Manjou were doing. You know, and Clifton Webb, you know, and all those people.
If you could pick any actor, you know, living or dead to work with that you never got the chance to work with, you know, who are some people that you would have just, you know, given your right arm to be able to work with?
Well, I've become a huge fan of a guy who I will never work with because of just. But you know who Tom Hardy is?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. Amazing. Have you guys seen Bronson?
No, I haven't seen that.
No.
Wow. Holy moly. I mean, that is amazing work. Just amazing work. Oh, I don't know. All of these. I tend to be typed into the sort of, you know, the intellectual, you know, the guy at the guy at the whatever it is, the lawyer or the mm-hmm. teacher or the so, you know, I don't know. So I don't have much hope that I will get roles with these guys.
One of my all-time favorite shows is MacGyver, and I read somewhere that you are or were close friends with Richard Dean Anderson. Is that valid?
No, we weren't close friends, but he and I were in the same he was in Legend.
Okay.
So we worked with each other for whatever it was, 8 months.
Okay.
What did you think about getting to work with Leonard Nimoy for the Alien Voices? What did you think about getting to work with him and the other ex-Star Trek cast on...
Well, I thought it was great. I mean, Leonard is a wonderful, wonderful man, really a terrific guy, and a consummate actor. Used to be an acting teacher, obviously wonderful director. So all of that was great.
Just my last two questions here are: do you have any besides the ones that you've already mentioned? Do you have anything coming up that you would like to, you know, promote or let us know about, any projects that you have coming down the pipeline?
No, I mean, I have a couple of symphony orchestra things that I'm doing.
Right.
One is in Rochester in May, and then the other is in Oberlin in April. I think I'm going to write a new piece about the Russian conductors or composers for a show here in Los Angeles in September. And after that, it's to get my boat ready for the South Seas, and you know, that's that.
Nice. Final question for me. What was it like having each one of your, I believe I read this right on the resumes and IMDb and whatnot, but having each of your kids appear in some of the projects, especially some of the Star Trek projects with you, and what are your kids up to these days as far as their...
My younger son is studying architecture at the University of British Columbia, and my older son... It works for an organization called IOM, International Office of Migration, out of Jordan, and he runs the Iraq mission, which is to figure out what's going on with the displaced people in Iraq.
Interesting.
And he was the one who played my son on Star Trek.
Okay.
Oh, cool. Final question. Do you have any advice for people who aspire to get into acting or voice acting?
Well, sure. Think of it as a sport, which is to say that it's all about doing it. And so you just have to do it over and over and over again. It sort of works with that 10,000 hour rule. You know, nobody gets really good at anything until they spend a good 10,000 hours at it. And not to, you know, say, well, I'm going to go to New York or I'm going to go to Los Angeles right off the bat, because you will most likely get eaten up. And more to the point is that most likely nothing will happen. So what they should do is that they should, whatever town they're in, Louisville, Kentucky or you know, Sacramento, California, they must exhaust all of the opportunities that they have in that town first, which is to go to the community theaters, to the opera, to the whatever it is that they want to do, and make sure they shoot as many films that they don't. Get to the point that they've outgrown their own town, and then begin the march, as it were, to these two, or there are probably three or four meccas, Chicago, New York, L.A., maybe Seattle, I don't know. But that's about the only, San Francisco, Boston, I don't know if you can really make a full living in Boston or not. But until you've made your, until you begin to move to those towns, and then get a resume going so that when you do come to New York or do come to Los Angeles, somebody can look at it and go, oh, well, you know, gee, you really got some stuff here. You know, okay. You'll still start at the bottom rung, but you know, people won't just blow you off as just kind of a wannabe. You will actually have experience.
Makes sense.
Yep. We'd like to thank you once again, John, for taking the time out of your busy schedule to hang out with us this evening. Is there any way for people to contact or get a hold of you for more information or just to chat you up online?
Websites?
I don't really want to do that.
Okay.
I just, only because I get into dialogues and I don't want to be rude and I just don't have that time. I just don't have the time to do that. And so that's why I do these things.
Actually, we appreciate it.
Yeah. I mean, that way you can ask me all the questions you want. I think I answered pretty fully. And this way you can play it to many, many different people as opposed to me, you know, one person at a time answering a question.
Right. No, I'd like to thank you too personally. I mean, I really appreciate this. If you would have told me, 18 years ago when I was watching, Star Trek: The Next Generation, that I'd get to talk to you someday, I would not have believed it. So I really appreciate you taking the time out and talking to us.
Well, it's my pleasure, and your questions were great. So I hope that you can use this material well.
Yes. Oh, yes, we will indeed. We'll ask you to hold the line, and we'll be back after this.
Quoth the raven, nevermore. And the raven still is flitting, still is sitting on the pallid bust of Pallas just above my chamber door. And his eyes have all the seeming of a demon's that is dreaming, and the lamplight o'er him streaming throws his shadow on the floor. And my soul from out that shadow that lies floating on the floor shall be lifted. Nevermore.
In any case, I'll be watching. And if you're very lucky, I'll drop by to say hello from time to time. See you out there.
You've just listened to Geekcast Radio on the Geekcast Radio Network. There are several ways to get in contact with us or leave feedback for the show. First, visit the website, geekcastradio.com, where you can comment on all of our different podcasts. Second, you can rate our show and leave us feedback in iTunes. Third, follow us on Twitter at geekcastradio. Fourth, become a fan on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/geekcastradio. Call the voicemail line, 502-526-5821. Please remember to tell us the show you are leaving the message for and your name. So until next time, unleash the geek in you.